third year scratch. Hey guys, thanks for coming back. My name is Alan Epley, and we talk and explore the lives of artists and people who have chosen the arts as a career, and how it happens. How does a sausage get made? Had a cool show this weekend. I was playing bass with Tight Phantoms. And that's me, Mike Lust, Mike Johnson from the Del Rey, and Stephen Howard, who was in Pinebender. And it was a ripping show. We played with Will Whitmore and Dead Rider and Torn Avalanche and a bunch of other great artists. The night before was Appleseed Cast. It was in Lone Tree, Iowa at the Gray Area Festival. And it was so cool. Everybody's camping out and tripping balls the whole time, apparently. But there were a couple vendors. There was some barbecue, there was boozes, and it was very well run and super chill and a very exciting experience. Very cool. So glad to have done it. If you guys have some questions, shoot them to me, alanepleytgs@gmail.com. And I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you're liking and what's not hitting. And if it's people you want to hear from, or somebody you know who is doing some great things, let me know, and love to get them on here. The guest today is Chris Prescott. Chris and I met about, honestly, 25 fucking years ago on an early Shiner tour where we got asked to go out with Jawbox for 6 weeks. And this was about 96, before Lula Divinia had come out. And all that was kind of in the works. And they were touring on their third record, the self-titled, after Sweetheart. And we were thrilled to be able to go along. It was a long-ass tour. We had a big bunch of breakdowns along the way, vehicle and emotional. And that's just kind of how it goes sometimes. But it was like an insane tour, and it changed our lives. But on the West Coast, we got to play with a band called Tanner. And so that's Chris Prescott on drums, and that's Gar Wood, specifically those two. And then the bass player is named Matt Olin. We'll talk about that a little bit. But it was a crazy tour. The first time I met Chris, great drummer. Then it turns out he ended up in Rocket from the Crypt for about a year. Then he jumped in with No Knife, and the Fire in the City of Automatons was a big record for me and for Shiner, all the guys. We stole a bunch of stuff from it. And that's what you do. You steal, because genius steals. It's also worth noting and super relevant that he is raising two kids with his wife and has been teaching guitar all along the way and drums for a long time. He's a guitarist in half of these projects. So that's what makes this so relevant to this podcast. More email. It's not yours. It's mine. So ignore that. Sorry, I'll get that changed. But he's living this life, which is at once jet setting and, you know, super, a lot of traveling with and doing a lot of great things, but also raising his family and kind of leading an otherwise kind of regular existence back in San Diego. Besides a lot of surfing and acting cool. But besides that, it's a regular existence. And so he has had a super prolific career and has just been a working drummer for the past 15 years. He's been drumming with Pinback, and also has his own band called Jade Shader. And we'll talk about Taryn Durfee, the bass player, and his untimely passing. And then the posthumous record that was put out. I was asked to sing on a couple of songs. Rob Crow from Pinback was asked to sing on a couple of songs. But I'm going to include the two songs that I sang on at the end of the interview here with Chris. He's such a sweet, laid-back guy, super surfery, kind of San Diego vibe. So he's known Jason Blackmore for a million years. They've been in the same kind of circles. Blackmore is a little more metal and punk rock. And Chris is more a little more nuanced and dynamic. So even from his new stuff, the Montalban Quintet, which is instrumental he's got with his brother, but the Jade Shader, Pinback, Rocket from the Crypt, he's drummed with Jimmy Eat World in different times, but just recently, about a year ago, he went out to Japan with them. Anyway, we'll talk about it all and a bunch of other shit along the way. Really appreciate you guys listening in. Yeah, so tell your friends and spread the gospel. And here's one more thing I want to say. The audio on this is a little strange. He was in San Diego, and I was in Chicago, obviously. And so he recorded himself also. We were speaking on FaceTime, but he recorded himself, and he sent me the file, and I kind of threw it in here. But there's a little lag in the time a couple times, and you can hear some feedback a couple different times. So you know what? You got to deal with it. That's what you get. Otherwise, it's not a terrible recording. So please enjoy me and Chris Prescott. Hell yeah. Where are you at, in your studio?
Yeah. Here, I'll show you.
And this is just, is that what you teach out of also? Oh, that's sexy. You got the single coils. Oh, that's dope. Where'd you get that?
A client of a friend of mine, and they passed away. And they were selling all their stuff.
Oh, wow. Is that a Fender?
Yeah, a real Fender? It's an American Tele.
Yeah. I've always been drawn to those knockoffs. I love the Honers. I love something where if I lose it, I'm not going to kill myself.
Remember you were talking about the Oscar Schmidt.
I've used the shit out of it.
Yeah.
I've used the shit out of the Schmidt. It was all over. I used it on, the first record on Suburban Hymns. And then I used it on the most recent record.
And you were talking about
how it for $29.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, fuck. What have you been doing?
I was actually at the beach surfing, and
show off
living the dream. So, I was down there, with my son, who's just kind of getting into it now.
Yeah. How old is he now?
He's 10.
Wow. So he got game?
Yeah. I mean, he's actually a really good skateboarder, but he's afraid of the ocean, you know, which I get it. You can fall on a skateboard and you're going to, you know, maybe break an arm, but you know, you'll.
Sure.
But you can definitely out in the ocean.
Well, that's probably smart. That's probably wise. And you've been doing that surfing for a long time. Every time I would see you, we were down in San Diego or LA, you would always say that. I was always thought you were kind of kidding, but you're actually truly a surfer and a badass.
Well, I'm not a very good surfer, but I definitely enjoy surfing.
And do you do that a lot?
Well, actually, once the kids appeared in my life, I surfed a lot less.
I'll bet.
But now that my son is surfing, and it's going to be a little more like, okay, let's go to the beach together instead of it being a thing where I'm going to slip away and go surfing.
Right. So you have three kids?
Two, actually.
Two. And what are the ages?
Yeah, so I have my son is 10 and my daughter Zoe is almost 13. She'll be 13 this month.
That's awesome. Is she moody and distant, or is she still awesome?
No, it's actually we kind of keep waiting for the shoe to drop.
Moody,
on
distant.
That. Yeah, but it's she's been great, and I think, you know, she gets a little nervous about stuff sometimes, so she stays a little close to us, maybe a little closer mm-hmm. than some kids do at that age. So she's not really doing that thing where she's really pulling away, and
right.
But as a result, I think it kind of makes her hangout time right now.
So, for sure.
And
do you feel like you have more time to hang out just because of just what you do? Do you find yourself more available for the kids?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my situation is a lot of times I'm kind of Mr. Mom. So, mm-hmm. Taking them to school, picking them up from school.
For sure.
I'm kind of like slash, Mr. Mom slash Schneider from One Day at a Time.
I love our recent references we use here. This is, we only use stuff from the past 40 years. So that's, well, you know, this whole thing is just kind of like a set of conversations I'm doing with so many of my buddies and people that I know that are doing amazing things, but also lead, you know, normal lives and have to, you know, there's a hustle to it.
Yeah.
But you and I have known each other for a long time. I'm so amazed that we've been able to like keep consistent contact for, I guess, 25 years or something, you know?
I think a big part of it is the fact that, we're both still doing it, you know, on whatever, however we're making that work. It's like, we're still hitting the road, you know? So like, I'll be up near you or you'll be out near me. It makes it a lot easier to, than someone that you know, but you never see them, and you might call them once in a while, but you know, like we'll hang out.
Yeah. And we're fans of each other's work have been able to work on each other's shit.
Oh, I know.
We'll talk about that. You and I have been, you know, being able to be on the Jade Shader stuff was a big deal for me.
Oh man.
But we met initially in, I guess it was 96.
Yep.
Shiner was out touring with Jawbox, and we were first on the bill on the West Coast. We were upset that there was some band called Tanner that was going to take the immediate support.
We gave it back to you though. Remember?
You did. You gave us the Tanner banana.
No, we gave you the middle slot.
That's right. Yeah. What happened with that? So it's you. You're a three piece. It's you and Gar.
And Matt,
what's Gar's last name?
Gar Wood.
Yeah. And Gar Wood, and he's in Hot Snakes now.
Yeah. And Matt Olin.
Matt Olin was. Matt was sick or something.
I think he was. I think he had extreme over partying syndrome. So as a result, yeah, we were on our way. It was in Portland, and so we all kind of went our separate ways that night in Portland. And then we met up in the morning. We're doing that, like, whatever, 3 hours or whatever, up to Seattle. And we were kind of hanging out in the van, but he was acting kind of crazy. And it was just, you know, it was like sort of tense in the van. And then all of a sudden we were passing SeaTac Airport, and he just kind of asked us to drop him off at the airport, and totally out of the blue. And so we dropped him off at the airport because at that point we were getting kind of pissed off too. And so we didn't really want to take him, but you know, it's a grown man. He says, I want to leave. So you go, okay, well, here's the airport. And so then we showed up in Seattle where Robin Taylor, our booking agent, we showed up at her house and had to explain that, we were here in Seattle, but now our bass player had left. Matt says as soon as he flew home, like as soon as he basically landed in San Diego, he realized that he just had made a mistake. Had too wild of a night and just wasn't thinking straight. But
wow.
Yeah. So we continued to play after that, but there was definitely a kind of a warning of, okay, well, how bad can things get? And the funny thing was, actually, I don't know if you remember our friend Eric, who was, kind of like roadieing for us. And he had done, I think only one tour before with our friend's band Inch. And the same thing happened when their band drove up to Seattle. Right before they hit Seattle, the bass player went insane and quit the band. And he felt like he actually, he was asleep in the back. And so when we told him Matt had left, he thought we were just pulling his leg because the same thing had happened to him a few years before. And he totally felt like he was seriously apologizing that, I'm so sorry I jinxed your tour. He totally thought it was him. And actually, it might have been him.
That's so weird. You know, when we heard you guys, when this went down, we just couldn't read you guys and your humor. Because... you know, it was very straight-faced, and like Gar wasn't, you know, he's kind of elusive and hard to read anyway. I didn't, you know, we didn't know you guys. And you're like, well, he left, or we dropped him off at the airport. And I was like, no, fuck, for real, what happened? You know, he was like, we took him to the airport. And I had to reckon that I just never was going to get the truth for actually what happened on that tour.
Oh, yeah.
That's really interesting. So Matt Olin continued playing with you guys after that for a while?
Yeah, well, we stopped. We probably stopped about 6 months later. We did a mm-hmm. couple other tours. We went out to the East Coast and we did a little thing with. But things were going great. I mean, we were so happy to be on that tour and.
For sure.
Stuff was. I felt like there was momentum for sure. I mean, we're just working on our second record at that point. But when things mm-hmm. get just too funky. Because, you know, it's never going to be a good job. So you have to really love doing it. Don't love doing
it. Yeah, if it's not good in the van. Yeah. Who put out the Tanner record?
The first one was on label? Caroline. Caroline, oh, wow. They put out. I don't know if you're familiar, but they, you know, Bad Brains. And.
For sure. Absolutely. No, that's a great label.
And Misfits.
Nice.
And then the second one was supposed to be on Caroline, but we could tell, you know, the winds were changing. At that point, Caroline had switched over to Astral Works. Because it used to be Caroline / Astral Works. It was kind of two labels. But then mm-hmm. basically, I think it was the Chemical Brothers were really popular, and they were an Astral Works band. So the whole label shifted away from rock music into electronic music. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, everyone would just... So,
dropped. Yeah.
Yeah. But luckily we had, in San Diego, the label down here was Cargo Records, Headhunter Records. So,
we were, oh yeah. And that's still pretty reputable and cool too.
Well, it's one of those things that I was just talking about this with someone else. Cause you talk to almost anyone who is on that label and they're going to, mm-hmm. they're going to have some gripe about it, but, mm-hmm. the reality is it was a good thing that it existed in our city because it was really easy to say, hey, put out this record. And, you know, they weren't putting mm-hmm. out everything, but it wasn't that hard to get on the label. And, you know, they did have
right.
people there, you know, promoting to radio and to press. And it was a lot better than mm-hmm. putting out something yourself at that time.
For sure. How many records did Tanner do? Just two?
Just two, and then a bunch of 7-inches. And a lot of people don't even know that second one came out because since it was on Cargo, and mm-hmm. we were broken up at that point, we basically just kind of sold them the record just to get it out and get a little bit of money. And but there was no, I don't think there was any, just came out. I mean, there was a lot of people that even live in San Diego that were fans of the band that didn't even know we put out a, that's Headhunter Records.
That's a drag. How long was it between the Tanner breakup and then when you started playing with the No Knife guys?
Well, actually, as soon as Tanner was done, I actually started playing with Rocket from the Crypt, and they were doing a thing where they were trying to get more keyboards and percussion into their sound, and mm-hmm. so they asked me to do just one show with them, and so I was playing organ and timbales and backup vocals and stuff. So. But then I ended up doing that with them for a year, and we toured out to the East Coast and Europe. And but the whole time,
that's rad.
Yeah, it was great. And then the whole time I'm thinking, okay, this is super good, but I'm just this random awkward dude up on stage with this great band, you know. So I figured at a certain point right. I need to get back on the drums, and there wasn't any kind of opportunity for me there. I mean, Adam's just killing it, and mm-hmm. So, the No Knife guys, their drummer had a total meltdown and like walked off and left them hanging a bit. So, and I was working.
That seems to be a theme.
It is. It is crazy drummers, I guess. But, well, actually, I guess that's not really the theme, but,
right.
But I guess the theme really is, people that don't really, keep themselves in check. Tend to mm-hmm. be unreliable, which creates mm-hmm. opportunities, right? I mean, there's a bunch of times I've been able to get into bands because someone else was, you know, partying, or there was just something that was, they weren't being reliable. And then
sure.
you happen to be someone who can play and you're reliable, then you can get work.
Absolutely.
But I was working at a bakery with Brian from No Knife, the bass player, and he and I were good buddies. We hang out a lot. And so as soon as their drummer quit, it was right away. It was like, oh, you want to do it? And actually, Tanner and No Knife, our first release was a split single together. We used to share a practice room, and So I knew all those guys, and there was, you know, we already had
interesting. How many records did they make without you, or did they have before?
Like, yeah, Noah and I had two records before I came into the picture. Then we did two, and some 7-inches. And
stuff. What year? Say it again.
Oh, 98. So Tanner finished in 97. I played with Rocket that year and the next year, and then right away was it.
And how long was it before, were they signed to like some reputable label, No Knife for Automatons? Who put that out?
Yeah, that was actually, they were on this label called Time Bomb. And
I know Time Bomb.
Yeah, that was Brett, Garino was the, he's basically, he made a ton of money being a manager for like No Doubt, Soundgarden, Social Distortion, Offspring. Everyone's manager. So in the 90s, that was a, you know, big deal. Those were all the big bands. And
right.
So he had this label that was kind of a pet project. And so we were that label, which was pretty crazy to join a band. And actually you get a paycheck. You don't have to do anything, but you get your monthly paycheck. You know, your practice room's paid for. I mean, it was just the gravy train for sure.
Man, that's nice.
Yeah.
How long did that last?
Well, I feel like it was a couple years, and then, you know, and then it was time to do the next record. And at that point, they wanted to renegotiate the contract, and rightfully so, because when the band first got on the label, I mean, they were really, really supportive and really great. And ended up getting us a great tour. We did a whole national tour, Sanity Real Estate, and who was on the label also.
Mm-hmm.
So there was lots of stuff that was really good about it, but it was also, it wasn't like a cool label. It was just something that financially there was a lot.
That's great. That record is super influential for me.
Oh, wow.
That's a big deal. Not only the drumming, but like his bass playing is so much of the heart of those tunes to me. Do you guys think that too?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Totally. That guy's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. He's kind of one of those, really, individual, I don't know if you call it like an autodidact, but someone, you know, basically he does what he does so well, but then you ask him to play a Beatles song or something. Man, what you do that? But he'll do his own thing, and it's so good, you know.
Right. Oh, but he doesn't necessarily know what he's playing at all, or necessarily.
No. I mean, like, you know, I mean, I don't think you could say, "Hey, play C." I'm like, what? So, but then he'll play something amazing, and it'll probably be in C. You know what I mean? But he doesn't. Well, he doesn't have the connect the dots type thing, which, you know, it's not always important for me. My background is more, you know, going to school for music. And so for me, I've always found that kind of ability to connect, music a little mathematically, I guess, you know, thinking about like, okay, you can know the sound, but you also can understand a little bit of theory behind it. I mean, I always find that to be really helpful, but it's not for everybody.
That's me too. Where did you go to school for music?
UCSD.
Oh, nice. That was kind of my approach too. Cause I like whenever like I'm writing where Life and Times or anything or Shiner, I would always just write. I mean, I definitely knew what I was doing and what key and like whatever else, but like I would never say, oh, I'm going to write in 7/8 in C sharp minor or something. I never would do that. It was always about feel. And then later on, if I was explaining something to the dudes, then I would say, oh, I think it's in 3 or something, you know, and I'd kind of like have to figure, I'd have to kind of go back and look at it more like, observationally, objectively or something, you know? But I always like really enjoyed, I think everyone should know how to play covers. Not everyone, but like everybody doesn't have to, but like, I think it's super helpful in like learning how to like write songs. It feels like there's like, did you grow up in cover bands and that kind of shit all along? And cause I learned so much playing covers.
Yeah. My first bands were cover bands for sure in high school. And, and actually I started playing with my neighbors in a band, and we just play at my friend's house. He has parties a few times a year, and we just play covers mostly. And I love it. I play piano in that band, so it's been a really cool, just, you know, okay, I learned how to play these three songs for this next barbecue, and you figure out, okay, I gotta learn,
yeah,
this or that. And so I love it. I think it really helps you to think about things differently. And also there's a ton of the music theory rules, quote unquote, it's actually just what your ear tells you anyway. You know, so sometimes you're playing something and you're trying to figure it out, you can follow your ear, but the rules will help you figure out things really quick too.
For sure. I fully agree. Are you saying that you still do the covers thing for even now?
Oh yeah. I totally enjoy it. Yeah.
So do I.
Yeah. We play like at my friend's house just down the street every few times a year, but it's just only basically the people that show up are just the people that are going to play. But at this point, it started off, there was like, you know what I mean? And then like a couple friends and, you know, maybe a couple wives, some kids running mm-hmm. around. But
sure.
We just do it for ourselves.
That sounds like fun.
It's so fun.
Yeah. That sounds like a lot of fun. I have I'm in with some Longman and Eagle bartenders. We started an Oasis cover band called Oasis.
Oh, you've been doing that for a little while, right?
And we did our first show in February and it was off the charts. It was so much fucking fun. You wouldn't even believe it. I'm sure you would believe it. But, and it's like, so it's filled with all these people who love Oasis, and we were actually a lot better than they were expecting. They were going to love it anyway, just because it's their friends and the, you know, people they knew. But like, it ended up being, I think we really blew some minds and it was so fun. And every song you play is a giant hit. So
right. Yeah,
it's always a slam dunk. Yeah. You know, it's fucking awesome. It's so fun. Yeah. So, No Knife was just for a few years, and then I had the last record too, but yeah. that was on an independent label.
Yeah. Our friend had a label called Better Looking Records, and the last mm-hmm. record was there, and We played a little bit past that. I think that was around 2000. Kind of wrapped up. And, yeah, so it just, same kind of thing. I'm a fairly nice guy, but I think back, I always was kind of the guy that would have the conflicts in the band. I think there was definitely some conflicts between me and one of the other dudes. And, it made it so it wasn't
creative
really,
friction.
Yeah, well, it just wasn't really fun to do the band at a certain point. And if everyone's mm-hmm. getting along great, and you just keep cruising, but when things are getting tense, maybe I could do something else.
Yeah. I got to that point somewhere in the end of the Shiner days, and it was, we were on doing some pretty cool tours, but there was a stress level that was uncomfortable. And I just felt like at a certain point, I was just like, I don't want to do this. I don't have to do this. You know, I think I felt tied into it. And that was distressing to me, you know? So what did you do when No Knife stopped? Did you just, I know you were working in the music store,
yeah.
right? Is that?
Yeah, I was teaching there.
And so were you teaching kind of throughout the whole thing, supplementing?
Yeah. Yeah. I started teaching in 91 and, I've been basically the whole time I've been touring, I've been teaching, mm-hmm. which is a great job for that, because, you know, you tell your students, hey, I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks because I'm going to be on tour, and they're cool with that. I mean, you're out there kind of doing it for real. So it's pretty easy to justify why you're not going to be there to teach them for that time. And another buddy of mine
absolutely
would fill in for me, and I would fill in for him. And so if I was on a tour, then he would, you know, pick up my schedule. Sometimes people would want to not have the break. They want to continue. But then the same thing, you throw some students to a friend, and then when he goes on tour, then you can fill in for him. So it would create some real busy, you know, weeks of work.
Mm-hmm. And have you found that it's been consistent, or with your students, or is there always a constant turnover? Because that was kind of my deal. I mean, I would have them for months, and then, you know, it was kind of up and down depending on whether mom and dad's paycheck was solid or not, you know.
I noticed a huge change after the I don't know, what was that, 2000? Something like that.
Yeah.
My roster basically went from, I don't know, like 20 kids down to like, went crazy.
Wow.
And I've been teaching a long time, and I never saw anything like that. And it was right around when people were really tightening the belt, you know, just, you know, for family finances and stuff. And the music classes were not a part of that. So,
yeah, I mean, it's down the line in people's importance. What did you do to supplement when that was going on?
Well, luckily, actually, it was a time when I had some good work touring. So I was actually the teaching was not really my primary income. You know, the touring was still my main income. So, and also, I mean, a big thing too is being a self-employed person, which I've kind of always been. There's going to be months that you're not making. Other months they're really solid. So for me, being married and having a, you know, partner with my wife, makes it so that things can be a little bit more like, if a 1 month is really rough, then I know we're not going to just be kicked out of our house. And I know that next month it's going to be better, kind of thing. And so you can kind of weather it when you have another person that's part of your team. So that makes a big difference.
Yeah, you can't hardly, I mean, I can't overstate Pam's, you know, part in this. But, you know, she couldn't do it without me in it also. And I know it's the same with you guys. And are you still doing the Airbnb outside and about back your place?
No, cool? No, we did that just for a short little while. And then a friend of ours moved in, and she's been here for a few years now. Which makes
it's a solid tenant.
Totally. And it makes it, again, like, you know, we try to live as cheaply as we can, so that you just don't have to stress. Because obviously when you're worried about money, it's not good for your general disposition, and it's hard on a marriage. So we just try to live as cheaply as we can. And
right. And San Diego is beautiful. It's a vacation destination for a lot of people anyway. So being able to go to the beach regularly kind of takes that itch away from, like, we always love to go down to Folly Beach in South Carolina in Charleston. But, you know, if I lived on the beach, I might not do that. You know, I know I wouldn't.
You have to remember to go though, you know, you have to remember, like, we live in this place that's kind of this resort town, but if you don't go to the beach, you can forget it. And then all of a sudden you go, wait a second, I haven't gone to the beach in a week or 2 weeks or whatever. And you go, okay, I'm going to go down to the beach. And all of a sudden you go, oh, okay, yeah, I live in this place.
That's a big deal. The San Diego scene always seems super kind of tight knit and kind of small towny. I mean, is that, you think that's accurate? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of, not incestuous stuff, but kind of, you know, everybody's kind of playing in each other's bands, and seems like a pretty cool scene, like a nice guys scene, or unless I'm reading it wrong.
It's hard to speak about it now. The early 90s, when things were really active among my peer group, it was a pretty amazing, supportive time. And we were going out all the time. You know, this is sort of pre-kids, and so you can kind of just do whatever you want. But we were going out all the time and playing and rehearsing and seeing bands, and go to rehearsal. After rehearsal, you go see some bands, you know. So everyone was supporting each other, and there was definitely a camaraderie, and it was a really good time to be playing music in San Diego. I don't know that it's that way now, and partly it's, there wasn't a whole lot of places to play. So back then also, like right now you could go and there might be 10 shows. Back then that wasn't really happening. Right. There would be a few shows. And so, you know, you're going to see your friend's band and you're running into other people that you know, and weird stuff, you know, like, you know, you just meet people on this kind of slightly superficial level of, you know, them from shows, you know, or, you know, seeing each other's bands or whatever, but but you end up kind of knowing a lot of people. And then when someone leaves a band or gets kicked out or whatever, you know, you know those people, and it creates opportunities. And so I think because of that, people are constantly creating these new projects because there's just a big group of friends that are all going to see each other. But now I think it's a whole nother situation. I mean, it's basically another generation of people that are doing music that I'm not really a part of that. But so it's hard to really speak on it. But I know that in the early 90s, there was a pretty great vibe happening in here.
That's great. It reminded me, I mean, me and the Shiner guys always felt like that was, they were, the Kansas City and the San Diego scenes were kind of simpatico. They had a certain kind of thing, certain kind of feel. So in 2003, No Knife broke up. And then what were you doing? What did you do? Did you pick up with, when did Pinback start?
Well, first I did the Jade Shader with Taryn. And
cool. Yeah. I didn't know if that happened at the same time or.
Yeah. It started right when.
Kind of overlapping.
Yeah. And the goal of that was, cause Taryn had a young son at the time and, and Carrie and I were planning on having our first child. And so the whole idea was, okay, we want to do a band of just people that we like to hang out with. And we're going to meet once a week and we're going to drink wine and we're just going to play music and we'll play some shows locally. No touring, nothing like that. And so that was the plan. Like Taryn would come over and we'd practice and record once a week. And eventually we did go on tour.
That sounds like a great plan.
Oh yeah, it was great. It was great. It was kind of going back to of what we enjoyed about music. And part of it is the friendship and just the laughs and
for sure.
Yeah. And so you just pick to play with people that you're just really enjoying. And, you know, that's really what it's about. So we did that. And then eventually, I kind of was doing two bands. So I left to do Pinback, but the Jade Shader continued. And then eventually Taryn got plucked up and he did Pinback with me as well. So there was kind of, so it was kind of a launch pad for that.
That's pretty great. How many records did, Jade Shader do?
Well, we did just one EP, and then the other one that you sang on just came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
That was our second.
Yeah, and tough days in there. And I don't know if you want to talk about it, but you know,
it's fine.
If you're okay talking about Taryn, Taryn had passed, had cancer. What type of cancer did he have?
He had melanoma, skin cancer.
Oh God, that's just like, did it blindside everybody? Well, and did you, or was it such a slow moving kind of like you just kind of watched the wave come in whole time?
Yeah, he fought it for 10 years, so it wasn't something that was a surprise.
Okay.
But the thing that was a surprise was that he actually got clear of it. I mean, he had a bunch of surgeries and they were able to cut it out. So he was clear enough to where he was on a trial for a cancer vaccine and that they don't want to give you unless you're cancer free because they don't want to mess up the trial, right? So. He was looking like he was, you know, maybe not permanently going to be good, but he was good. And, but I think he basically stopped going to the doctor, stopped checking up and something appeared on him. I think it was on his back. And, that was while we were doing the band, he was like, oh, you know, I've got, and, it just was really aggressive and he was able to, you know, he kept fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting, but eventually just, you know, spread all over.
Oh man. Yeah. A huge deal. But you guys had been recording and you were able to take some of his tracks. He's such an influential bass player and he has that kind of like vibe where, I mean, were all the songs kind of based around his bass riffs? Cause it feels like that. It kind of has that same kind of thing.
I'm not totally sure. Well, I mean, when I think of Taryn, and even though I played with him in bands, but I always think of Boilermaker, which was a really big thing for me. And I think so much of that is just the bass is so critical. But actually, a lot of the Jade Shader stuff was things that I would probably demo the rough parts of the songs in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would, you know, put put his bass parts into it. And I would never try to tell him what to play.
Okay.
Because he, right. you know, you're going to get something a lot better if you just let him figure out his own thing. Instead of saying, hey, play this and this and this. Because you got, I mean, it's Taron Durfee, so it's kind of ridiculous to tell him how to make a bass line, you know?
Yep.
But a lot of the songs were written, just cooked up in my studio.
Well, that's cool. I wasn't sure about, sometimes you can tell where the origin of the song is from, and I could never like kind of fully figure it out. But I do know there is a certain sound that you guys have, and it kind of, and I don't want to say it sounds like Pinback, but there is a certain feel to it where it's, there are some similarities between it. I mean, it's not as, sometimes Pinback hits me as kind of proggy almost, you know, like the way their lines work together. For being as like kind of successful as they've been on an indie vibe, kind of, it also is like really kind of proggy in a certain way. So yeah. Do you think that?
Yeah, I hear it for sure. I mean, Zach doesn't listen to a lot of music, but he definitely is a fan of Rush. So
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So there's definitely moments that are, I think that he is inspired by that. I mean, Zach's another one of those guys that he really rarely ever listens to music. He doesn't really know anything about any bands. I think he knows, he knows about the Police, Steel Pulse and Rush. Like basically if you start talking to him about bands, like that's about all he could really. And even then Rob always messes with him too, because he'll say stuff like, all right, Zach, tell me the name of three Rush songs. Because Zach will say, Rush is my favorite band. And then Rob will say, okay, tell me the name of three of their songs. And then he might be able to tell you, but he might not.
It's hilarious. I was stoked to be asked to sing on those Jade Shader songs.
Oh, yeah.
And that record came out last year. I'm going to put a couple of those, or at least one of those songs here at the end of this so people can hear it, because I'm super proud of it. And I was really glad to be involved. I'm glad you asked. It was a big deal.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, man. So how does Pinback write, and when did you start in with them?
Well, okay, so those guys, I'm not personally involved with the writing of that. And part of it is that I think they had gone through a bunch of lineup changes. I think by the time I joined the band, I think they had gone through 13 different people, not just drummers, but I mean, you know, a lot of members. And so they started realizing that as the band was becoming kind of successful, and it was actually becoming work, you know, that they wanted to basically make it so, okay, we're the songwriters, we are the band, and we're going to hire you to be the drummer. So my involvement was very much like
as a session guy.
Kind of. Yeah, right. And I think part of it was to not have an obligation of like, oh, okay, well, if there's a, you know, a hit on the radio, then, you know, how much of it do we really owe to you? Instead of it being like, okay, no, this is, you know, you work for us, and we're going to keep everything sort of separate and clear. And, which make things a lot simpler. But also, as now that I've been in the band for like 15 years or something, sometimes it feels a little weird. Like, okay, I've been in this band for 15 years, but I'm not really in the band. You know, stuff like that sometimes feels a little weird. But I think at that time, they had gone through so many people that they weren't really sure if they felt like, it didn't really make sense for them to say, okay, here, new guy, you're going to be a member of the band. Mm. And then maybe a year later, you're not in the band anymore. So it was just creating a lot of confusion.
I definitely see it from their point of view, especially having, you know, a fair amount of success, you know, and now you got to like get this guy in, and you got to start cutting up, you know, all the paperwork with this guy, you know, the royalty stuff and whatever. It just gets messy, as opposed to just paying him for that and then paying for the tour. And he's still a bro and is, you know, we have a good time together and drinking whiskeys or whatever. But I definitely can see that.
And I think even on a...
It would be less messy.
Totally. And even just on a stupid sort of superficial level, you send out these promo photos of the band or whatever. And then every time you send one out, it's different people in the photo, you know, because you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's just sort of, it's mm-hmm. like, wait, who's the, I didn't see that guy. Who's this guy? Right. So,
right.
It kind of got distilled down to where it's just those two guys and that is mm-hmm. the band. But speaking to what you're saying about the process of writing, mm-hmm. and that's definitely something that takes, those guys a long time to agree on stuff. And so I think that's why there's such a big gap between records. Because Rob mm-hmm. will write a ton of songs and Zach will write a bunch of parts, and they're basically, the rest of the time is them trying to negotiate how to turn those things into songs. And in fact, the last record,
a pinback record.
Oh yeah. Man, it's a real struggle. And the last record was 5 years after the previous one, and it almost didn't come out. I mean, because they couldn't agree on the songs. So, so basically I think there's 10 songs on the record, and what it came down to is, okay, you pick five and I'll pick five. And that's what the record ended up being, because they weren't able to, kind of collaborate in a sort of normal way. Just, they're both mm-hmm. very, very specific about what they do. But honestly, but with that being said, I think that there's something kind of magical about those two guys playing music together. That mm-hmm. they don't really get individually, so mm-hmm. so they're working really hard, but I think it's worth it.
Right. So when Rob's writing, it could end up being for any number of his projects, and then he'll kind of like pick out which ones sound like Pinback things, or do you think he's writing for Pinback?
No,
he's writing
for Pinback. I think it's pretty specific. I think there's some things that will end up on Rob's solo records. But that maybe would have been in back songs, but mm-hmm. but I think mostly when Rob's writing, it's you know, if he's writing something for Pinback, I think it's probably headed that way.
Right. So there is a new record in the can, or is it?
Well, I mean, there was tons of leftover things that were not they weren't able to agree on them. There's a couple things that are done. Right. A 7-inch just came out of a new song, and there's another one that we've been playing live, but it hasn't come out yet. And there's a few mm-hmm. others. There's some cool stuff that never came out. And I don't know. There probably will be another record, but I don't really know. It won't be anytime real soon.
Right. And are you guys touring soon? Do I see that in August? Is that mm-hmm. happening?
Yeah, there's a tour in August, and then a tour in November, and then a tour. November is the West Coast, and then February we're gonna, I think, going back over to Europe.
Rad. And is it just kind of like time to go out and do some touring and make some money kind of tours, or is it in support of anything particular?
Yeah, there's nothing new coming out. I think basically the thing that's happening in August, which actually I'm not even on that tour. I'm gonna be busy backpacking with my family. So,
nice.
Yeah, had a conflict there, but my friend Jason is going to be filling in on that, and then I'll be doing the other ones. But yeah, there's not really any new material other than that 7-inch that came out. But you know, people oftentimes want to just hear the songs from the first few records anyway. So when you play, you're not really making new fans as much as you're playing to the people that were fans of the music that came out years ago, mm-hmm. which is a little bit of a weird feeling, but the fact that there's still work and we can tour and you know, good.
I think that's pretty consistent with a lot of people's experience. You know, I mean, everybody wants to hear the earlier shit, and you know, if you get to play a lot of your new stuff or even some of it, then you know, that's kind of the way then you're lucky, you know. Shiner mm-hmm. is, we just got out of making we're tracking a new record. But I don't know how many songs it'll be. It may just end up being 6 or 7 songs, just like a kind of short-ish kind of thing. And we're going to make everybody listen to our shit, though, you know? I mean, we're going to make them sit through it. We'll play a bunch of stuff,
Well, you're notorious about that. I mean, you're notorious for, you show up and you go, here's the whole new record. You know, like with the Life and Times, you did that a few times, man.
I know.
That's brutal. But it's like whenever I see those shows, and then I'll like, because the record will be new, So maybe I haven't heard the record, mm-hmm. but I'll see the show. Mm-hmm. And then you listen to the record after and you go, oh yeah, I remember this part. I remember watching this. I remember seeing this.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon mm-hmm. as you put those two experiences together and you're like, but now I want to see the show again. Cause now I know the songs, you know? So
yeah,
it's such a weird feeling.
That's always that conundrum where well, I'm glad it had an effect. I think we just were trying to make it as difficult as possible on to make it to be successful. We want to really make everybody have to work for it. But I've always loved that. I think I like a lot of the records have that kind of like flow where it just seems like it would be a shame to not perform it live that way. And then, mm-hmm. so now we're going to be doing Tragic Boogie, re-releasing that for these shows at the end of July. So should be interesting.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes. So what's up next for you? Backpacking in August?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, also I've been real busy. I've been doing the Montalban Quintet thing for a long time.
Which is
my instrumental project with mm-hmm. my brother. A lot of horns
sure.
and stuff like that, strings. So I'm still doing that.
Absolutely.
And that's been picking up some momentum. New record came out. And so, yeah, basically just picking up tours. Oh, I had a random tour. I toured with Jimmy Eat World last year. I don't know if I told you about that, but.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did that happen?
Zach just wasn't able to make it. They were on a serious, crazy, you know, new record came out. They were touring, like 150 shows or something really crazy. And, mm-hmm. they had a break where he was supposed to head home and just have some family time. And, then they got an offer to go to Japan. That was right in the time that he was going to have off. And I think he mm-hmm. just needed a break. And so they asked if I could fill in on that tour. So I did 11 days over in Japan with those guys.
You're like, all right, I guess no, I'll.
It was insane. Yeah, it was. I was so.
It had to be insane.
Yeah, it was so cool.
Wow. Were they kind of like the Beatles over there? Was everything
no
huge? I mean,
no,
everyone's
they're,
the Beatles.
They're not that famous in Japan, which is really kind of really interesting. But we actually opened up for this Japanese band called Man with a Mission, which is
mm-hmm.
oh my god, it's like they wear these outfits almost like mechanics jumpsuits, and then their heads are these really expensive custom made wolf heads, and their music is it's like a cross between Incubus and I don't know it's basically a band like that, like a modern rock that has some scratching in it.
Wow, weird.
Like total anthemy chorus. It's so weird, and like insane laser light show. But in Japan they're huge. I mean, the shows, so we toured with them over there, and the shows literally sold out in like 10 minutes. You know, we're playing
these
places.
How big places?
Like a couple thousand. I mean, it was just
every.
And for them, for this band, these are the club shows. Like, these are the small club shows. Because normally they're going to play they're going to play an arena in Tokyo. They'll play arenas. And so they're playing these 2,000 seat clubs, And before Jimmy World was even announced on the ticket, they all sold out in 10 minutes. Everything sold out. So we show up
Holy
to play,
shit.
And probably a lot of the people weren't even really familiar with the band. So it was kind of interesting. We did some headlining stuff over there too, but it wasn't anything really big. I think we headlined a place that was like...
Right.
Wasn't like it here, it would be much bigger.
Sure. No, they're definitely rock stars here in town. Or in the States. I remember my first experience with them. No Knife was touring with Jimmy Eat World, and then you came through and you had an extra date to play with Shiner at Davies Uptown in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
It was like
yeah.
Gherkin's first show, I want to say.
Really?
I want to say it was, yeah, it was his first show with us. And then the next night was going to be in like, I can't remember where. And then we played with Superchunk in Atlanta a couple days later. But yeah, I want to say that was Gherkin's. Was he on that show or was it Tim? Do you remember?
No, Tim wasn't there for sure.
Yeah, yeah, Tim, it was Gherkin. That was Gherkin's first show. Very strange. Shiner opened for No Knife and Jimmy Eat World at Davies Uptown. Very strange.
I remember
moments.
That clearly. That was a good night.
That was crazy. Yeah, it was a strange moment. That was when Jimmy Eat World was still considered like indie rock, you know, and they were like super kind of pitchforky darlings.
But, yeah, we did a whole month with them That was right when Clarity came out. So like we had Fire in the City came out and Clarity came out at the same time, and we toured the whole country with those guys. So that was amazing. Rad. And it was like, you know, tour. The shows were good, but it wasn't. I mean, it was, you know, you're like a few hundred people, that kind of thing. It wasn't
sure.
It wasn't right. anything crazy, but it was solid right. though.
That's so rad. Well, dude, thank you for rapping about everything.
Yeah.
And for doing what you do and for being consistent and not, I don't know. I find a certain like, you're just very at ease being kind of this long-term musician. You don't have any like, inner need to go start some other job somewhere, some 9-to-5 doing thing. You know, this is what you do. And like,
it's hard though, man. You know, you gotta, it's a juggle, you know, to make it work for sure.
It definitely is, man. It's a hustle. And I'm, you know, so that's really what this is about and what I'm talking to everybody about. And, you know, there's a lot of great shit that happens, like that we are career musicians, but it's also, it's tough. You know, it's a real dance you got to do in order to like, especially if you're raising a family like you and I are doing. And, you know, it's not, it's always something you got to plan for, you know, but I don't ever necessarily get jealous of any of like the people that are on our street that have these like kind of long-term 9-to-5s. It doesn't really appeal to me in any way.
Yeah. I mean, that's a last resort for sure. I mean, yeah, you know,
resort for sure.
There's a lot of ways to live and I can't imagine. I mean, I would do anything I needed to do for my family, right? But when you can mm-hmm. simplify and try to live a little cheaper, and mm-hmm. You know, have a little more time to do artistic stuff, then mm-hmm. have to, you know, do something that's completely unrelated to what's in your heart. But you do what you have to
for
do,
sure.
and that's why I think, I mean, for me, I'm so grateful that I have a team with my wife and we were, you know, raise the kids together and just, it all works out. But, mm-hmm. but I also understand for a lot of people that they don't have a choice. Like they've got to go get the job or whatever, because they just need to. And so I definitely don't look down on that at all. I think that that's totally honorable too. And I feel really grateful to not have to do it.
For sure. All right, dude. I really appreciate you rapping with me, man.
Thank you. Yeah. Nice to see you.
Fascinating and super cool. I will, let me know if you're going to be in town and I'll come out. And
that sounds good.
We'll get drunk.
Right.
All right. All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. See you, Alan. Bye.
Thanks, man. There it is, Chris Prescott. What a sweetie. Love that dude. Long-term home slicers, he and I. This is a couple of the songs I sang with the Jade Shader. This is The Sky is a Sea, and then the second song is Secret Truths. Thanks, you guys.